Welcome to All Signs with Ann Fisher. I'm Matthew Rand, in for Ann today. Last month, NASA unveiled the first images captured by the James Webb Space Telescope. The images were stunning, but so was the news that one of the Deep Space Observatory's 18 hexagonal golden mirrors had been struck by a micrometeoroid. Fortunately, the damage appears to have been small, and the James Webb can continue on its mission, peeling back the mysteries of the early universe. We're talking about all things space today. Tom Burns is an esteemed amateur astronomer and former director of Perkins Observatory at Ohio Wesleyan University, where he's taught creative writing and other forms of writing for many years. Welcome back, Tom.
Always a pleasure to be here, Matt.
Well, I'm excited about this show. Tom, NASA released the first full-color images from the James Webb Space Telescope on July 11th. I immediately, of course, made the one of the Carina Nebula my computer wallpaper. I don't know if you did, too. What was your reaction to them?
Gronk, wow, was my first reaction, because the resolution is tremendous. And that very first image that President Biden revealed in a special broadcast just blew me away.
The deep field image, yes, is that, yeah, where
yes,
just which, thousands of galaxies in one shot.
And that's the point. They haven't even bothered, so far as I know, to count them yet. So you have NASA people saying thousands and thousands. But remember that the Hubble deepest field, which was a similar field of view, understand this.
Right.
This is a field as big as a grain of sand, or the head of a pin held at arm's length.
Wow.
Had thousands and thousands of galaxies. The best Hubble could do was 10,000 galaxies. This maybe didn't get to that, but with some work, they're going to get 30,000 galaxies and a single field of view, I guarantee.
I think I was reading, too, that the exposure time is a lot shorter. Like with Hubble, yes, it was hundreds of hours of compiling the faintest photons coming in from these distant galaxies, and much shorter for James Webb. What else sets the James Webb apart from Hubble and other ground-based observatories?
Well, it's observing in the right part of the electromagnetic spectrum, especially if you want to see distant galaxies. Trouble is, galaxies that are farther away are traveling at nearly the speed of light away from us. So you get what's called the redshift, the Doppler shift, which causes all that visual light to shift downward into shorter wavelengths to the infrared, also known as heat. That is, when it comes to infrared, we can't see infrared, but we can detect it. It's the warmth of the sun hitting your skin. Well, the Hubble or the Webb Space Telescope is big enough and sensitive enough in the infrared that it can detect the tiniest fraction of a degree difference in that heat coming to us from the distant universe, and as a result, it can see galaxies that the Hubble, which wasn't very good in the infrared, couldn't see at all. And thus, when you look at that first image, you're seeing all of these red galaxies, so red that you couldn't see them if you hadn't seen them in the infrared. And what's interesting about it is a lot of them are behind the cluster of galaxies in the foreground. And the Hubble or the Webb is taking advantage of gravitational lensing, which allows that light to be bent around the galaxies. Thus, you're seeing a galaxy. The latest I've heard is 13.1 billion years old, and the whole universe didn't start until 13.7 or 8 billion years ago. So you're starting to see earlier and earlier galaxies. The Webb has detected a galaxy, I'm not sure it's in that image, that began to form 200 million years after the Big Bang, which is about as early as you're going to 285 million years, which is about as early as you're going to get, because there were no galaxies, because there were no stars before that.
Incredible. You are listening to All Sides. I'm Matthew Rand, sitting in for Ann Fisher today. And we're talking with Tom Burns, former director of the Perkins Observatory at Ohio Wesleyan University, about the James Webb Space Telescope and all things astronomy, backyard or otherwise. If you have a comment or question for Tom, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsigns@wosu.org. Now, NASA didn't build this thing just to send us back pretty pictures. What are some of the major discoveries scientists are hoping to learn with the James Webb Space Telescope?
Well, as far as galaxies are concerned, you have this long timeline of the Big Bang, which is happening right now. The Big Bang wasn't the start, it was the whole process. So what you're hoping to do is to fill in gaps in that timeline. It's like when biologists try to fill in the stages of human evolution. But beyond that, the web is also good for small detail as well, so that what you do is you take the spectrum of not a planet now, just to show you the kind of resolving power of these telescopes, but the atmosphere of a planet. And you're able to, using that spectrum, you're able to detect the chemical elements and compounds in that atmosphere. So you're looking for Earth-like planets. You're looking for oxygen and nitrogen and carbon dioxide. But what you're really looking for is H2O, water in the atmosphere, because so far as we know, water is the one critical element, one of the critical elements for creating life.
And it's able to detect this. I take it the light streaming from that planet's host star passes through the atmosphere, and the spectra of those elements in the atmosphere make their way all the way to us, and James Webb is able to pick it up.
And what you're looking for, interestingly, when the light streams through the atmosphere, is you're looking for the lines of the spectrum that indicate certain chemical elements and compounds, but they aren't going to be there. They're dark lines called Fraunhofer lines because the atmosphere filtered them out. This is probably one of the key discoveries of astronomy, that you look for when you're looking at a star shining light, you're looking for what's there. But you're also, when you're looking at a star, you're looking or a planet, you're looking for what's not there, because the outer atmosphere of the star or the atmosphere of the planet filters out those lines.
Okay, that makes sense. Just talking about some of the discoveries so far from the James Webb Space Telescope. Just yesterday, I think they released another photo. This was the aptly named Cartwheel Galaxy.
Yes.
It's about 500 million light years from Earth, and just like it sounds, it looks like a great spoked wheel in space. What's unique about this one?
Well, what's cool about this is that a smaller galaxy, which is not in the image, passed right through the center of the Cartwheel Galaxy. The Cartwheel Galaxy started out as your classic pinwheel, that is, a flattened disk with spiral arms. But what happened is when the other galaxy passed through it, not a single star probably crashed into any other star because of the enormous distances between stars in any galaxy. I'll give you a sense of that. If you were to make our sun the size of a volleyball, then the closest star to our sun, Proxima Centauri, about 4.25 light years away, 1 light year is 6 trillion miles, would be, in that scale model, 5,000 miles away in Hawaii. So you don't have stars crashing into other stars, but their gravitational effect is when that small galaxy pulled through, it dragged stars around and dragged stars out of that galaxy and caused the spiral arms to disappear. All of a sudden, you have that kind of central hub, which is spread out into a rough circle. And then the stars at the edge of the galaxy have been spread out into a rough circle. So it really does look like a wheel, a cartwheel.
Yeah. You were talking a minute ago about this, I think, and I just wanted to double back. The James Webb, you told me before the show, we were talking, and you said it's the James Webb Space Telescope is pushing back the timeline for the Big Bang. Can you kind of explain what that means and how our understanding of the Big Bang is shifting as we get these new observations from the James Webb?
What you begin to realize is that stars and galaxies formed more or less simultaneously. And you're starting to see stars and galaxies that push the envelope back from 300 million, formation of stars from 300 or 285 million years after the Big Bang, now 200 million years after the Big Bang. So stars and galaxies are forming earlier than perhaps astronomers thought they did without these high-resolution images from space telescopes.
And if I'm remembering correctly, before stars and galaxies started forming, you had very rapid expansion, right? And the first elements eventually coming to... walk us through that part of the timeline.
Well, you start out from some singularity, infinitely dense or very dense area, which then expanded rapidly. Within the first few billionths of a second, it expanded faster than the speed of light. But you still have this mix of subatomic particles. It wasn't until 385,000 years after that rapid expansion that all of a sudden the photons are being released from that subatomic stew, and atoms, that is, nuclei of atoms like protons, are beginning to be formed. And that was a magical moment, 385,000 years, because all of a sudden we can detect those photons, those particles of light in the form of microwave energy, which is all around us. But when you look at it, and this is the key, when you look at that microwave energy from 385,000 years after the Big Bang, you see that it is lumpy.
Yeah.
And those lumps are what are eventually going to form clusters of galaxies and galaxies within them and stars within those galaxies.
We have to take a break in a minute, but I did want to get to the news about the James Webb that had sustained some micrometeoroid damage to its mirror array. NASA says it's not a big deal, at least right now. First of all, what are micrometeoroids? And then how badly was it damaged?
Well, the thing that you have to realize is there's this whipping through space, and there isn't much out there at that Lagrange point, but there's stuff. And so that main mirror and other parts of the telescope are bound to be damaged over time as Earth smacks into some poor
comet trail or something like that, or
just a piece of space crud, basically. There are a lot of ways that there can be space crud. Some of it is left over from the formation of the solar system, some left by passing comets, yada, 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 yada. And because Earth is traveling so fast, those tiny objects are going to hit that telescope going maybe at 100,000 miles an hour, and that is bound to damage the telescope. And there are going to be segments of that 18-segment mirror that will become unusable, but not to worry, because any one element of that mirror is still better than anything that we have. But over time, the image will degrade some because elements of that will become useless, but that won't happen for a long time, we hope. That really is just a matter of random luck or lack thereof.
Yeah, I was holding my breath when they launched it on Christmas Day, just hoping nothing went wrong. And then this news that some debris had struck the telescope, and my heart sank, but glad to hear that it's still performing well.
That is inevitable. And the telescope is so designed, especially its main mirror, to sustain some damage and still function.
All right.
More or less properly.
Well, we all sustain a little damage and we still function more or less properly.
That's right.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Matthew Rand, filling in for Ann. We're talking with Tom Burns, former director of the Perkins Observatory at Ohio Wesleyan University, about all things space today. If you have a comment or question, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Still more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Matthew Rand, filling in for Ann today. We're taking a look at what's going on in the night sky this hour. So if you have any astronomy questions, send them our way, or any great stargazing experiences you'd like to share, we encourage you to give us a call. That number to call is 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Still with us is esteemed amateur astronomer and former director of the Perkins Observatory at Ohio Wesleyan University, Tom Burns. And Tom, you wanted to talk this hour about the Milky Way, our galaxy of residence, especially viewing it in the summertime. What can you tell us about how to go about seeing it when it's warm out?
Well, the best thing to do is to choose a moonless night, or at least if you're going out in the early evening, you want it to get completely dark and you don't want there to be a moon. Any good calendar will tell you when to go out. And what you're going to see is, it was for me at least, a life-changing experience, because everything around you is in the Milky Way. The chair that you're sitting in right now is part of the Milky Way, and so are you. But when you see that stream of light stretched out across the sky like the backbone of God, you're seeing the basic structure of your home, the universe you live in. And if you look kind of over to the south, mm-hmm. in the early evening, you're going to see the hub of your Milky Way galaxy. If you think of a galaxy as a flattened disk with spiral arms, in the center, there is a bulge. Mm-hmm. And that bulge is quite visible and obvious if you're looking from dark skies, if you look in the direction of the constellation Sagittarius, the Archer.
That's where the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy is located,
that
right?
That is correct. A black hole the size of our whole solar system.
Yeah.
And you won't see the black hole, of course. It's black.
Right.
But and you're also looking in that direction to a tremendous amount of dust. But a pair of binoculars in that general direction will show you star clusters, the gaseous nebulae, the gas clouds out of which stars are born, and all you need is a pair of binoculars and dark skies to see them. I remember the first time I looked in that direction with a pair of binoculars, I had no idea what I was seeing. But I saw a little fuzzy patch, a little star cluster, et cetera, after star cluster. And then You work your way up to the top of the sky through the constellation Aquila to the constellation Cygnus, where, even though you're not looking at the center of the Milky Way, you're also not looking through a lot of dust. And you're looking through a spiral arm, and you are seeing an incredible number of stars. You can imagine the moment when Galileo first looked at that section of sky. And remember that before 1609 or 1610, when Galileo looked at that patch of sky, people had not a clue what the Milky Way was. Aristotle thought it was vapor rising out of the ground.
Excuse me.
And when he pointed his tiny little telescope, one-inch lens.
Yeah.
Your binoculars at home are better than that. He saw that it was made up of a multitude of stars, and at that moment, the universe changed for human beings forever. It all of a sudden, in a very real way, wasn't some dome or sphere of the night with Earth at the center. It was a universe made up of uncountable stars.
So, I'm curious to, sorry to cut you off. I'm just curious about the you talk about using a pair of binoculars. Is that, in some ways better? I mean, you might think you need a big 12-inch Dobsonian telescope to really see these deep space objects. But is a pair of binoculars good or in some cases better to have on a night sky?
In my heart of heart, and believe me, I have built some Mondo huge telescopes in my day. In my heart of hearts, the best way to see the Milky Way is just with the binoculars you were born with, your own two eyes. And then you observe with binoculars and you see these condensations, these fuzzy things. And then you build bigger telescopes and you get better and better views of those fuzzy things. It's a natural progression. And often, people will go out having really, I've known people who have never seen the Milky Way, and they'll go out and buy a big telescope, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a big jump. It's a steep learning curve. It wasn't so much for me because I evolved from seeing, for example, the Milky Way to binocular observing to knowing more or less where to look when I built my first telescope.
I know you got to get out of the city to really take it in and see. You want to get those low light conditions to be able to take it in as well as possible. Does summertime afford any advantages to, say, the wintertime when looking at the Milky Way? It's always up there, but is it better for you in the summer?
Well, each one has its advantages. One thing you can count on, more or less things change, is that you're going to get some hazy but clear nights in August and in July. But then the period in early September through the beginning, middle of October, you're going to get a higher percentage of clear nights. And that's when it's great to see that late summer sky. And you will get clear skies in the winter, and they tend to be clearer because the humidity is lower. But you know what it's like in the winter in Ohio, so that the best meteor shower of the year, the Geminid meteor shower in mid-December, I have attempted to observe many, many times, and I think I've managed to observe it three times.
There you go. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Matthew Rand, sitting in for Ann today, and we're talking about astronomy, all things up in the night sky. If you have a question for us, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Tom Burns, former director of the Perkins Observatory at Ohio Wesleyan University. You mentioned the Geminid meteor shower in December, Tom, but there's another one coming up very soon.
Right. Well, I wanted to say one more thing about the Milky Way. On your way up from Sagittarius to Cygnus and beyond, you're going to run into what is, to me, the most spectacular thing about the Milky Way.
What's
that? It's called the Great Rift. What it is this dark dust lane that cuts the Milky Way in two. So in some ways, the Milky Way is most impressive about what's there, but it's even more impressive. I'll never forget the first time I saw the Great Rift. What's not there? What's obscured by that dust?
Yeah, you really get a sense of the 3D space that you yourself are occupying.
That is correct. And I really think that's true. Most people spend their whole lives looking down at their feet. Look up at the sky and you get real perspective, not just about your place in the universe, but its vastness and complexity. And you have this eventual desire to build or buy telescopes so that you can see. And don't get me wrong, Webb Space Telescope, magnificent images. But there is something extraordinary about using the binoculars you were born with, or using a pair of binoculars, or using a telescope to collect those photons, to experience that one-on-one, your confrontation with the vastness of the universe and your tininess by comparison.
Love it. Moving on to the meteor shower, the Perseid meteor shower coming up in just a few days, right?
Oh, yes, that's right.
Are we going to be able to see it, though?
Well, that's a fair question. Normally, I'd say go out on the night of the 12th, is it? I think, yes, and the morning of the 13th, especially the morning of the 13th. You're going to see the largest number of meteors in that last couple of hours, in that last hour before morning twilight sets in. So 4 a.m. on early in the morning on August 13th. However, this year, we have a problem.
Uh-oh.
The big street light in the sky, the moon will be full. And anybody who observes the sky will tell you that when the moon is full, it rises at sunset and sets at sunrise. So you're still going to be able to see some meteors. But instead of 60 an hour, my record is 120 an hour. In that last hour before morning twilight, you're lucky if you see 10 to 30, but they'll be bright ones.
Yeah.
Nice thing about the Perseids is there is that percentage of bright meteors.
You were telling me that even on a good night, when conditions are ideal, people going out to look at meteor showers, they kind of do it the wrong way. What are some of your tips for some supreme viewing?
Well, first of all, get out of town. You need those dark rural skies. Luckily, we now have places. One of the nice things about belonging to the Columbus Astronomical Society, there I got the plug in, I feel much better.
Very good.
Is they have developed observing sites that they use that are in dark skies. And there are public observatories, notably the John Glenn Astronomy Park near Logan in the Hocking Hills, that are magnificent places. And they're open 24/7. Don't go on a program night because then you have to register for parking. But are magnificent places to look at meteors. And that's first thing. Dark skies.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing, people show up. I've been at many a dark sky observing site when people who know about these things will show up, come screaming into the parking lot where I'm parked with their lights on instead of their parking lights, and stop, get up on the hood of their cars, occasionally look up at the sky, see a couple of meteors, saying, well, that was a disappointment, and go screaming off into the night. But you have to be patient.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to wait. You have to observe all night. I like to take along a pair of binoculars and occasionally take a break and look at the stuff that I know that's up there. Nice thing about the Perseid is you can scan up and down the Milky Way. Don't spend too much time doing that, though, because you just want to lie flat on your back, look straight overhead, or in the case of the moon, you want to look in the opposite direction from the moon. You'll see more meteors, and just wait it out. Just really enjoy the sky and wait it out till the first hints of morning twilight begin to obscure the view.
And you want to protect your night vision too. Red light is good for that, right?
That's correct. Yes. If I have a little red headlamp that if I need to go to the bushes, so to speak. And let's face it, you're drinking a lot of coffee over the course of the night. You do occasionally have to go to the bushes. You wear a dim red headlamp or something like that so that you can see where you're going. And above all, try to avoid lights of any kind. If there are another thing to consider is light on the horizon from local cities, you want to observe away from those directions as well.
You are listening to All Signs with Ann Fisher. I'm Matthew Rand, filling in for Ann today. We need to take another break in just a moment.
Can I say one more thing?
Oh, absolutely.
In this case, going out on the night of the 12th and the morning of the 13th probably is a loser's bet. However, the Perseid meteor shower is a long meteor shower. So you're going to see some meteors if, for example, you go out on the morning of the 9th and the 10th, when there will be, and go out in the early morning before morning twilight, and you will get some period where the moon is not obscuring the view.
We have time for a call here. Dex in Fairfield Beach, you're on the air.
Hi. As a thing I've heard since I was younger, very young, that if you were in a deep enough well, you could see stars in the daytime.
Interesting.
Yeah, there have been actual experiments with that. And the answer is, I've never been down a well, so I don't know. But you know, even if you're down in the deep well, you're still going to get some blue lit up sky. So the question is there a bright enough star at the depth of that well to be able to fight even the brightness of that patch of sky? And the answer to your question is, I've thought about this. I've seen some experiments about it, and I've come to a definite conclusion on it. I have no idea. But I'm ever down in a deep well,
that's as conclusive as it gets. Well, Dex, thank you so much for your call. If you have a comment or question astronomy related, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsigns@wosu.org. You're listening to All Signs with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Signs. I'm Matthew Rand, filling in for Ann Fisher today, and we're taking a look at what's going on in the night sky this hour. If you have any experiences, any great stargazing stories you'd like to share, we encourage you to give us a call. That number is 614-292-8513, or email us at allsigns@wosu.org. Still with us is esteemed amateur astronomer and former director of Perkins Observatory at Ohio Wesleyan University, Tom Burns.
Glad to be here again.
Glad to have you. And we saved some of the best for last here. The morning planetary extravaganza, as you call it, is ongoing. What can you tell us about it?
Well, the nice thing about this is not only are you going to see, if you go out, all the naked eye planets except for Mercury. For that, interestingly, right now, I mean, starting on the 15th, when Mercury is farthest from the sun, you go out into the early evening, you look straight west after the sun has set. Please, thank you very much. Don't look at the sun. You'll need a perfect western horizon to do this. I mean, no trees or buildings or anything like that. And if you, you might not see anything, but if you grab a pair of binoculars, you're going to see right to the west, you're going to see low to the horizon, only about 5 degrees. That's about a fist width, by the way, if you hold your fist at arm's length.
So if you've got a line of trees blocking your sight, you're out of luck.
Forget it. You need a perfect horizon for this. I have scouted out all the perfect horizons in my around my house over time. And if you use a pair of binoculars, you're going to see a red, red point of light, and that's going to be the planet Mercury. Once you've seen it, you might be able to pull the binoculars down and see it with the unaided eye. Confusing things, I noticed, is that it's right next to the star Regulus in the constellation Leo, at least I think it was. I'm trying to remember the star map, yes. So it'll be the one, if you see both of them, it'll be the one on the left, but it will look, it always looks red, not because Mercury is red, but because it's being filtered through that same kind of atmospheric effect that causes sunsets and sunrises to be red. Oh. And then you go take a nap and get up at 4 a.m. or so.
Drink some more of that coffee.
Yeah, you're right. Or either that or drink 12 or 14 cups of coffee, which is what I do. And then you can, by about 4 a.m., you'll be able to see the planetary extravaganza. By the way, if you stay up all night, you'll be able to see Saturn and Jupiter, which rise relatively early. But if you want to see all of the planets, then 4 a.m. about is about the best time to go. This is before it's gotten completely, or before morning twilight is going to spoil the view. And then over in the southwest, first thing you're going to notice is a yellowish point of light. It's right next to a star, Delta Capricorni, but it's brighter than Delta Capricorni, is the planet Saturn. Binoculars will not help you here unless you have really big, high-power binoculars. I've been able to see the rings in my pair of 20-power binoculars.
Oh, wow.
But for that, you'll need a small telescope. But just seeing it is cool, even if you don't have a telescope.
And you were telling me they if you get up early in the morning and go looking for these, you'll see them basically in a line along the ecliptic.
That's right.
And
it's a kind of arc across the sky that is more or less along the path that the sun follows across the sky, because basically the solar system is like marbles rolling around on a plate. Not quite that, but kind of like that. So you see this great arc, and what you're looking at is that invisible path, the ecliptic. And the first time I ever did this, and let's face it, folks, if you live long enough, you're going to say, oh, yes, this again. I just marveled at the fact that there it was, you know, and the planets marked it out.
Yeah, and just, again, like we were talking about, of just standing there and taking in your place in the solar system and really appreciating the 3D space that you're standing in. You were telling me about Mars in particular. If you look closely, you can see another planet.
Yes, that's right. If you're in dark, dark rural skies, I'm going to look up the Uranus will sometimes reach naked eye visibility. Right now, it's at magnitude 5.8. The limit of visibility for most human beings is magnitude 6. The numbers go in the opposite direction. So it just might be, just might be visible to the unaided eye. However, a pair of binoculars, it should be easy. And right now, I was just marveling at this. Uranus is about 5 degrees, that's about a fist width, right above the planet Mars.
So, and act now because it's going to move.
That's right. And Mars zips across the sky. So Mars is zipping toward the left, as it were. But the nice thing about the internet, God bless it, is that you can go on the internet and find a map of the motion of Mars. It's mostly Mars, by the way. Uranus doesn't move very quickly. And you can see this change. And plan your observing session accordingly whenever you go out. But right now, if you look, it's Uranus is just quite literally a fist width straight above Mars. And it should be easy because there's nothing else that bright in that direction. It's going to look like a little blue-green dot in a telescope, a little blue-green point of light in a pair of low-power binoculars.
We have a call, Mac, in Dayton. You're on the air. Hi, Mac.
Hi, you guys. Hi, how you doing?
Doing well. How are you?
Good. Listen to your program all the time. I think it's awesome. Yeah, I just got back from Canada a couple weeks ago, and I had taken my phone up with me, obviously, and I used a particular app where you can actually orientate your iPhone, is what I have, up to the sky, and it will illuminate exactly what you're looking at. So in other words, it knows exactly where it is and what you're looking at by its position, and it doesn't use cellular service because we were out of cellular service. It uses its own GPS, and I don't know quite how it does it, but you can tap on whatever object it is, and it'll give you a description, where it is, what it is, and also shows things like rocket bodies and when they were launched. Very, very cool app.
Oh, yeah. I have four of them on my phone. But and they are nice because the good ones will indicate, for example, when there's going to be a pass of the International Space Station or something like that, or a pass of those cursed communication satellites that are ruining the night sky. And also, just for purposes of identifying the planets, I have one right here on my laptop right in front of me to remind me where these planets are, although because I'm not looking at them. It's pretty obvious which planet is which if you know their appearance.
Sure, yeah.
It's nice to know.
Yeah, oh, it is. I have one of those myself, and you can set it to where it shows up all in red so it doesn't, again, ruin your night vision. And, it's super handy.
They're really cool this way. You see something bright in the sky, and you simply hold the phone up in that direction, and by gosh, it's Saturn, or it's Jupiter,
it's
or
pointing
it's
right
Venus
at it,
or whatever. I thank goodness for them, because these days I don't get as many calls because I'm no longer director of Perkins Observatory, but I always dreaded when Venus was in the evening sky because people would call me up and say, a UFO, UFO, it's Venus, I would say, but now people are holding up their phones and saying, oh, well, it's just Venus.
It is bright, and you'll notice it when it's up there. In other news, the launch of Artemis 1, scheduled for later this month, possibly early September. This is the unmanned test flight of the rocket designed to take humans back to the moon. Are you excited about this?
Hey, yes, I am. And I've been excited about it for, what is it, more than a decade now.
Well, since 1972, the last time we went, right?
Well, that's right. But for a while, it became clear that we weren't going to go back. But then was in 2009, Obama took the remnants of the old Orion program and converted them to this new Artemis program. And then excitement began to build. But as the program was delayed, I mean, the launch was supposed to happen a couple of years ago, as I recall. And so it looks like now they finally tested the launch vehicle and it didn't blow up. So it looks like this is actually going to happen at the end of August.
Yeah. And what's left to discover about the moon, and why send people back other than it's amazing that we can do that? But what's left to discover about the moon, and why do we have a moon anyway?
Well, there's a lot left to discover about the moon. Eventually, the moon will become a place where human beings will live permanently, I am sure. Just because, for one thing, the moon is a great place to observe the night sky.
Well, I can see that.
On the far side of the moon, away from Earth, the moon blocks the view of the Earth, and you're getting the darkest sky. Also, there are places on the moon, perhaps at the pole, in places that are in permanent darkness, where there might be ice. Ice means water. Water means you can use the water for a lot of different purposes, not just to drink, but to break into hydrogen and oxygen to make fuel and air to breathe. There's a good reason for going to the moon and staying there, which is what Artemis really intends to do. The purpose of Artemis is not to go to the moon. The purpose of Artemis is to build a permanent base where human beings will go and stay for extended periods.
Will you be signing up to live on the moon?
No, thank you very much. I would settle for a flight aboard one of those MiGs where you get, you know, like 10 minutes of seeing the dark emptiness of space. Back when I was a youth, there were companies, startup companies, that were intending to build what SpaceX and the other company are doing now and make these short suborbital flights. And it was only like $2,000 to buy in. And I was tempted then.
Tempted, yeah.
I have to say, I'm thinking about starting one of those GoFundMe pages so that I can afford the $1 million or $2 million or whatever it
is. If you do that, I'll chip in $10 for you.
But that's it for me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, though.
That's it for me.
Yeah, so, yeah, but my other question was, you know, why, you know, you've written about this, why scientists think we have a moon in the first place?
Well, the first thing to realize is our moon is weird. That is. You look at Mars, it has two captured asteroids. Mm-hmm. You look at Jupiter, it has moons that formed with the planet. You look at Neptune, it has Triton, which is a captured object like Deimos and Phobos, except it's a captured dwarf planet is Triton with Neptune. But then you have our moon, which is enormous by moon standards. Earth, 8,000 miles wide. Moon, 2,000 miles wide. And you realize that this is probably not a captured object, although people, astronomers, thought it was a captured object. Mm-hmm. And it didn't form at the same time as the Earth. It must be the result. We didn't know this until the 1970s, by the way, after the long history of humanity and astronomy puzzling this out. It must be the result of a gigantic collision. Two of them, in fact, maybe.
Two of them.
This kind of big impact model supposes that an object about the size of Mars, which is about 4,000 miles wide, that's half the diameter of Earth, smacked into Earth, squirted out on the other side. That object became part of Earth. Squirting
right
out the other side was stuff from the right underneath the crust called the magma. Squirted out material that went into orbit in smaller pieces and formed, latest hypothesis, not one moon, but two.
Fascinating.
So they're in the same orbit. And this second moon, which is smaller, is slowly being attracted toward our moon, splattered into it like a slow impact fender bender, splattered into the moon and made it look the way it does, much different from the side that faces Earth.
fascinating. We're going to have to leave it there, but this has been a really enjoyable
hour.
That's how it goes. We've been talking with Tom Burns, former director of the Perkins Observatory at Ohio Wesleyan University, about all things space. Thank you for listening. This is All Signs with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.